Welcome back to Shattering Myths. America's engagements now in the Islamic world blend between absolute stupidity, complete duplicity, and obnoxious hypocrisy. We're creating the enemy and then going to war to justify our military against the enemy that we have created. We bomb an enemy into existence, and then we try to bomb them out of existence. We provide an enemy with weapons, and then we try to destroy those very weapons. We try to say that Assad must go, and then we engage on behalf of Assad. We recognize that Iran is the biggest threat to the region, and yet we give Iraq to Iran. It's mind-numbingly stupid. Glenn, we have on the line, and I'm sure he has a comment about all of this mess. Good afternoon, Glenn.
Yes, before I get into the military things, you'll be happy now I'm calling in with my contrarian hat on to save you from your big boo-boo.
Oh, great. Thank you. I always like being corrected. What was my big boo-boo today?
Schizophrenia is not multiple personality disorder. Multiple personality disorder is also known as dissociative identity disorder, and the two aren't even the same class. Schizophrenia is a psychosis. Multiple personality disorder is a personality disorder. And the reason this is so frequently confused, especially among the general public, is because, and I'm sure you know from your linguistic studies, that the schizophrenia carries the connotation of a split,
right?
Splitting, but it's not a splitting of the personality; it's a splitting off from reality. So that's where the confusion comes in. So schizophrenia actually good inroads have been made in recent decades in controlling it and understanding it with medications, controlling it with some effective medications. We've seen more widespread acceptance and understanding of schizophrenia in recent decades. We even see this, TV show called Perception, where the actor is a genius professor who has schizophrenia. And
the kid in Goleta that killed so many people in the first three, where he took their lives with a knife. They were his roommates, and then he went out and killed others. He was not a multi-personality disorder.
It was schizophrenia.
And he was on and off medication and treatment. And it is a disproportionate number of the times that we find mass murderers. We find in their immediate past a treatment for a mental disorder of one sort or another.
With these SSRIs, the thing now with the mass shooters and stuff, almost all of them have been treated with depression with selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. Schizophrenics are rarely violent. Schizophrenics are much more likely to be homeless and victims of violence than violent perpetrators. There are psychoses where there are psychotic murderers. But the vast majority of people killed in this world are killed by sociopaths, in high places, highly intelligent sociopaths.
So what you're trying to do is ruin a perfectly good joke, that old joke that has survived
that
the ages, that about schizophrenia, that we used to be schizophrenic. I used to be schizophrenic, but we're better now. You're going to ruin a good joke, and here it was that they're now announcing that schizophrenia is not one disorder, but in fact eight disorders. So you ruined a perfectly good story with the truth. What fun is that, Glenn?
I know. What can I say? It's a myth, demythologizing. What can I say? Roses are red, violets are blue. I'm schizophrenic, and I am too. It's just totally wrong.
Okay. My two points that, besides my poor attempt at humor, and I didn't even get a chuckle from Scott as a producer listening to it, so it was a very poor attempt at humor. But I did make 2 points. One is that a disproportionate number of the mass killers have one common denominator, and that is treatment and medication for mental disorders,
right.
Demonstrating that we are in a long way from being able to call this a science. We are a long way from actually being effective in the treatment of mental disorders, and may in fact be making the situation worse with our treatments and medications. That those 2 points, the association with mass killings and our failures in this regard, would you support those two extrapolations from the evidence?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I would personally, I would like to see all government officials elected or appointed drug screened and tested for mental illness. Far more people, 100 people killed, number in the millions who are killed by suit and tie sociopaths in high places and who have no empathy whatsoever.
Yeah, I've got a couple of issues too with the whole mental disorders, wherever you want to call them. One is that when a person is being treated for a mental disorder that disassociates that individual from reality, that impairs their judgment,
right.
For that treatment to remain private, when in fact they can be a danger to society, whether they're a danger to themselves is immaterial. I have no problem with that being between the psychologist and the patient. But when they are dealing with a disorder that disassociates them from reality and or impairs their judgment, and they then become dangerous to society, as was the case with this idiot in Goleta outside of Santa Barbara with UCSB. His parents knew that he was such, the police knew that he was such, and the psychiatrist that had treated him knew that he was a danger to others, and that ought not be private. That information ought to be made publicly available.
And I would suggest there that, and again, especially with regard to schizophrenia, historically the vast majority of people consigned to mental hospitals were schizophrenics. Now, today, that is changing rapidly, and you see a lot more personality disorders and mood disorders such as depression or bipolar disorder, so you're seeing much more of these things. Mood disorder people can be much more dangerous. The average schizophrenic, and I'll bet you with this guy, if more were to come out about his history, you can have comorbidity, which is more than one problem going on at the same time. So
yes.
I would suggest that there's a strong possibility that there were personality disorder aspects to his history.
Yeah, but I would also be willing to tell you that that the diagnosis on mental disorders is weak, that there is low correlation between the diagnosis and the actual disorder, and therefore it is one of those areas where we just do not have effective means, A, to properly diagnose the problem, and B, to treat the problem. And about 20 years ago, maybe 30 years ago, there was a liberal push in Washington to make it vastly more difficult to put a mentally ill person in a psychiatric facility and to hold them against their will. And so a very large percentage of those who were in these psychiatric facilities, many of which perhaps should not have been there, but many who should have been there were released. Many of those ended up being homeless on the street and just a nuisance.
But also,
I think we got a significant uptick in mass violence and mass killings because of this mass release and the consequence going forward, where it becomes increasingly difficult for a psychiatrist or psychologist to disclose a potential threatening individual to authorities and for the authorities then to do anything about that individual.
Well, yes, but historically, there's a mixed bag here for sure, because
of course,
historically, you know, the labeling of people, the application of a psychiatric label can be
correct,
you know, very so, very disempowering socially,
right,
in terms of employment,
of course,
and stuff like
of
that.
Course. I'm with you. My guess is that a disproportionate number of the people in psychiatric institutions were there for the enrichment of the institution and not for the betterment of the individual or society.
Well, I've worked in a state institution, and I can tell you, if they, you know, if they work.
But you worked in a state institution during the time that it was very difficult to institutionalize somebody based upon one person's evaluation of them. You've got to be pretty sick to be institutionalized today.
Well, in certain states, in Pennsylvania, they use the term 302. Someone is 302, confined against their will for 3 days, 72 hours
right.
for observation, if they can be construed as a potential danger to themselves and others. That's the baseline
right.
criteria. Very often people are discharged to home after being 302, you know, receiving care, and so they're not, you know, long-term, institutionalized long-term. So there's been improvement with that in terms of discerning, you know, taking some time to discern where the person's at. I think the vast majority, a lot of these shooters and stuff, if you look at their backgrounds, they have, some of them have actually been manipulated by high-level, you know, majestic 12 types, you know. Some have been restrained, you know, had personality issues and with violent video games and stuff like that, and almost all have been on SSRIs. So
yes.
it's the depressed population on SSRIs that I think right now represents the greatest
yes.
number.
Yeah, yeah. Almost all have taken mind-altering drugs, legally prescribed in most cases. And it is that the prescription of those drugs and the use of those drugs and the patients who take those drugs going on and off of those drugs has created a breach in judgment that has made mentally ill people more prone to commit acts of violence.
Absolutely. Well, and plus the history of the psychiatric establishment is just absolutely reprehensible. They've been wandering
yes.
around the Keystone Cops through the entire 20th century, from school of thought
right.
to school of thought to school of
right.
thought. And, I mean, James Taylor's song, Fire and Rain, I've seen fire and I've
yes.
seen rain, that's all
right.
about his, you know, brief stay in a mental
right.
institution as a
yeah.
youth. And,
well, look at Freud and his use of mind-altering drugs, LSD in particular, and the
right.
test by the CIA and mind-altering drugs. And, you know, there's the old line that every psychologist needs one. Last week, Mr. Kerry ruled out cooperation with Iran, stating that its engagement in Syria and elsewhere precluded America to partner with Iran. But the Iranian supreme leader, the Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, claimed on Monday that the U.S. had actually requested Iran's cooperation via the U.S. ambassador to Iraq. So one of the two is lying. Either the supreme leader of Shia Islam, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, or John Kerry. One said that he would not ask and rule out asking Iran for cooperation. The other said that we were asked to cooperate, and we said no. In fact, according to the Ayatollah Khamenei, I said no because they have dirty hands. He added that the U.S. was seeking a pretext to do in Iraq and Syria what it already does in Pakistan, bomb anywhere without authorization, end quote. You know, it doesn't really matter.
Who said that?
Pardon?
And who said that?
The supreme leader of Iran, the Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. Now,
okay, before you go, one slight correction. At least one of them is lying. It's not necessarily the case that one of them is telling the truth.
That is correct. At least one of them is lying. In this particular case, I think that it is that one of them is lying. I think it's Kerry. I think that Iran was asked to cooperate. And the reason I say that is because the most effective force in Iraq now, in opposition to the Islamic State, and the most effective force in Syria against the Islamic State, are both Iranian. Hezbollah and the Revolutionary Guards. Both have been deployed in Iraq against the Islamic State, and they're both Iranian. Moreover, the Grand Ayatollah al-Sistani, who is the highest-ranking Shiite cleric in Iraq, he is an Iranian mullah. And the government is completely acquiescing to and dependent upon him. And he has, along with al-Sadr, hundreds of thousands of Iraqis in militias. And the militias have also been more effective than the Iraqi Shiite military. And so whether or not America formally asked Iran to participate or not, Iran is the most effective force in Iraq and in Syria in opposition to the Islamic State. That's why America's willingness to bomb the Islamic State, which is comprised in Iraq mostly of the Awakening Program that America sponsored, is so counterproductive. Because in Syria, that means that we're now on the side of Assad, and in the Sunni-Shia conflict, we're now on the side of Iran. I mean, it's an absolutely brain-dead, suicidal, self-inflicting wound proposition.
Right. Well, the Peshmerga Kurds are pulling their weight too, but they, you know, they're
on that. But the Kurds are playing America and Obama for an absolute fool. I mean, they came up with this thing that, see, the America has always been, we want a unified Iraq. The Kurds don't want a unified Iraq. They want a Kurdistan, and so. They're desirous of America arming them so they can have their Kurdistan. And so to get American arms, which they got $1 billion worth of American arms, they claimed that they were the most effective force against the Islamic State. And when that didn't get them enough arms, then they claimed that they were the defender of the Yazidis, the Zoroastrians. And remember, their big thing is 100,000 Zoroastrian Yazidis that are stranded on this mountain and encircled by the Islamic State and poised to be eradicated in genocidal fashion. And America dropped, you know, 100,000 MREs and hundreds of thousands of bottles of water and then launched a raid. And we arrived on the top of the mountain to find a couple of goat herders, about 2,000 shepherds, who said, thank you for the meals, thank you for the water, would you please leave? This is where we herd our sheep. And the whole thing was an illusion, specifically for America to be arming the Kurds who wear the black uniforms and operate under Peshmerga, which means I embrace death. They're suicidal jihadists. You know, the whole thing is just—it's just a pile of lies and deceptions and hypocrisy and stupidity. It's amazing. The only intelligent thing for the U.S. to do is to disengage entirely from that region. The United States, in the middle of an energy crisis, where America is destroying its economy because of its deficit of trade over the importation of oil. And the fact that it buys a disproportionate amount of its oil from the very nations that wish to destroy it, those Islamic nations, decided that it was a time to punish ExxonMobil. And so the United States banned technology transfers and fined ExxonMobil. And so it is likely that it will stop ExxonMobil from drilling in the Kara Sea on behalf of the Russians. And so ExxonMobil, that has had its largest revenue streams be its partnership recently with China and Russia in building pipelines from the Caspian Sea and from developing new oil and gas reserves in the Arctic and off of the eastern coast of Siberia and throughout Siberia is being thwarted from doing so. Sounds pretty stupid. But you see, the United States is no longer open to business for oil development. America has punished British Petroleum to the point that there is no American oil and gas company willing to take the risk to drill. And so we have taken our government, which has been so anti-business, so anti-energy, so anti-pipelines and drilling, and we have put ourselves in a position that rather than encouraging them and recognizing that America could be energy independent, that America could stop funding Islamic terrorism, that America could be back in a place where we have economic prosperity as opposed to destroying our wealth, has a government that is punishing banks, punishing manufacturers, and punishing energy companies. And never has it been so egregious as it is under this, the Obama administration. Dateline Moscow. A week into a ceasefire between government troops and pro-Russian rebels in the Ukraine that was orchestrated by Russia. That country's prime minister, the prime minister of the Ukraine, who is just a ridiculous foul-mouthed liar, offered a pessimistic assessment of the chances of it holding. He said that Vladimir Putin intends eventually to conquer all of the Ukraine. Now, he knows, as does any rational person, that's untrue. Russia wants no part of Kiev in western Ukraine. Nothing. Wants absolutely nothing to do with them. It views them as thieves. It views them as malcontents. It views them as thugs. It wants nothing to do with them. It wouldn't take the western Ukraine if you gave it to them on a silver platter and said, please take me. It's a liability. Now, in the east, that's a different story. In the east, they speak Russian. In the east, they are ethnically Russian. In the east, in Luhansk and Donetsk, they manufacture products that Russia has used for decades, using Russian technology, with Russia being the primary purchaser of those products. And they grow grain and other crops. In the east, they don't want any part of the thugs in the Ukraine. They don't want any part of the Kiev regime. They're disgusted by them. Russia is willing to protect the ethnic Russians and would absolutely welcome Luhansk and Donetsk into Russia in accordance with the people's will, just as it did Crimea. But I can tell you for certain that the Ukrainian Prime Minister Yatsenyuk is a dreamer, a liar, a sociopath. He is making the statement because he wants more American money. The $25 billion that he was given was just a taste treat. He wants more. He wants more American weapons. He wants more American intel. He wants more European support. He wants to be part of NATO. This whole episode has been to turn the Ukraine from a Warsaw Pact country into a NATO country, not recognizing that it's not an asset to NATO, but instead a liability. Only the military backing, he said, of the North American Treaty Organization, NATO, can defend the Ukraine, said the prime minister of the Kiev government. Mr. Yatsenyuk reiterated his support, voiced in the summer, for the unlikely eventuality of the Ukraine joining NATO. This was a shift from his position and offers the pro-Western coalition an additional avenue to achieve its will. The White House and Pentagon acknowledged Friday that the U.S., this is another story, but it is, to me, just amazing, that the United States is engaged with NATO in the Ukraine by conducting NATO military operations in the Western Ukraine. And yet, we are sanctioning and blaming Russia for defending its people in the Ukraine. Well, the White House and Pentagon are contradicting the Secretary of State now. He said, quoting the President of the United States, that that America is not at war with the Islamic State. And now Secretary of State John Kerry is being told, no, that's not correct, that the White House and the Pentagon really are at war with the Islamic State. Now, I'm not sure, other than congressional approval, what the difference is between being at war with the Islamic State and dropping bombs on them and not being at war with the Islamic State and dropping bombs on them. Other than one requires congressional approval and the other does not, what is the difference? If your response is to drop bombs on them, is that kind of like the Vietnam conflict? It wasn't a declared war, but we just lost 50,000 lives and killed a few million people and dropped $100 billion worth of bombs, but it was a conflict, not a war. Is that because we didn't have enough respect for the Vietnamese? Is this whole thing a ruse that says, well, okay, the Islamic State isn't worthy of the United States declaring war on it because, according to the CIA, there's only 20 or 30,000 participants in the Islamic State, and how could a nation as powerful as America engage in a war against an entity that doesn't have a national status, that doesn't have an actual military, that doesn't manufacture any military hardware, that doesn't have its own currency, that is only 20,000 individuals strong? I guess America doesn't want to declare war with the Islamic State because it's laughable that a nation of 300 million people with the largest military on earth would declare war against a non-national entity without its own currency, without its own status internationally, when they are some 30,000 strong. And I guess it would be even more embarrassing when America fails to achieve its objective, which is to eliminate them. So we'll just not call it a war. We'll call it a conflict. The White House press secretary, yes.
I've often thought about this, and we used to have a Department of War, War Department, and we had have a Defense Department. But during the 20th century, the Geneva Convention very much formalized, the rules of humane war or justifiable war. And by not having a declaration of war, it gives you more of an opportunity to skirt the rules. We say, no, we're not at war. So that rule about those gases or the rule about those bullets, you can kind of get around
the rule about prisoners of war, rules about protecting civilian populations. All that goes
exactly
out of the window.
Exactly.
When you're not in a war.
You can't be held accountable if you're by the rules of war if you're not at war.
Yeah. Well, the White House and Press Secretary Josh Ernst and the Pentagon spokesman, Rear Admiral John Kirby, used almost identical language when pressed by reporters Friday as to whether or not the expanded military operation against the Islamic State was in fact a war. They quoted, in the same way that the United States is at war with Al-Qaeda and its affiliates, the United States is at war with ISIL, Ernst said. Well, first of all, how could you be at war with Al-Qaeda? I mean, what are there now? 3, 5, 10, 15, maybe 100 Al-Qaeda members worldwide? I mean, Al-Qaeda's largest affiliate, which had actually no affiliation with Al-Qaeda other than they used the name, is Al-Qaeda of the Arabian Peninsula. And at their peak, they were estimated to be about 300 militants strong. The United States has killed about 250 of them. Now, while they're disruptive, certainly, in Yemen, America shouldn't care who's in power in Yemen. It's just a group of one thug versus another thug. And in Afghanistan, there is no Al-Qaeda. And in Pakistan, Al-Qaeda is so diminutive as not even to be a hiccup compared to the Taliban and compared to so many other fundamentalist Islamic terrorist groups there. And then all you've got left is Al-Qaeda and the Maghreb. And they're irrelevant compared to the Islamic terrorist groups in Libya and throughout the Central African Republic and the Boko Haram in Nigeria. Al-Qaeda is a figment of our imagination. So we're at war with a figment. So we're going to be now at war with ISIL. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We talked last week in a conversation with Glenn about a respiratory virus that was making children in particular sick across the United States. It's now been picked up by the major media outlets. This story begins, the mysterious respiratory virus that's been making children ill across America has made its way to the Northeast. Scores of enterovirus D68 cases have been confirmed in New York State, officials said at the end of last week. Connecticut hospitals have reported cases as well. The virus, which is responsible for sending hundreds of children to hospitals in the Midwest, especially affects children with asthma. And there is no vaccine because it is a virus. There is no cure. The Connecticut Department of Public Health, citing the Centers for Disease Control, says that there have been 100 confirmed cases of the enterovirus D68 in the last few weeks. Earlier this week, the CDC confirmed the cases were found in 19 out of 22 samples from Kansas City, Missouri, and out of 11 of 14 samples from Chicago, in children ranging from 16 weeks to 16 years old. So we do have a problem with a respiratory virus that is causing havoc across the country. Now, after the administration released details of the July mission to rescue journalist James Foley, remember how the Obaminator didn't want to make it look like he was inept, and so he released to the public that he had authorized a rescue mission to free James Foley using the military. Well, that rescue mission was so secretive, and I guess, and so unsuccessful, it wasn't even detected by the Islamic State. They didn't know. But when the Obaminator bragged about having conducted it, the Islamic State responded. And now they have dispersed all of the remaining hostages to many locations, making it, of course, much more difficult for the U.S. military to locate them. At one time, should the U.S. have actually been able to conduct its mission advantageously, it could have freed every hostage. They were all in the same place. But now with the admission, they're all dispersed. Now, one of the reasons I bring this up to you is the fact that this administration wants to point at Snowden, claiming that he's a traitor and that the information he has released has aided and abetted the terrorists that would do us harm when there's nothing that he said that was unknown to the Muslims. The Muslims have known for a very long time that America was monitoring all electronic surveillance, which is why they were using pen and paper and couriers, and not using satellite phones or the internet or email or anything of that nature to communicate, nor just standard telephones or cell phones. Everything he said, they knew. They didn't know that America had launched a raid to rescue them. And so they have now dispersed those individuals. So rather than pointing the finger at Edward Snowden and saying that he has aided and abetted America's enemies, ought the fingers not be pointed right back at this administration? That to make itself look like it was trying to do the right thing to rescue them, actually made all of the hostages more vulnerable? Here's a quote. It says, any time you disclose very highly sensitive tactical information, you're going to give away your roadmap, your strategy, said Republican McCaul, a Republican for Texas, who, as chairman of the House Homeland Security Committee, receives regular intelligence briefing. It's very highly damaging to the hostages. That's what this administration did when it released that information, to try to make itself look good. Now, what's also interesting in this regard is that the Obama administration threatened to sue, threatened to incarcerate the family of Foley if they offered to negotiate a ransom for their son. That the Obama administration told Foley's family that if you negotiate with ISIS to provide a ransom, as other countries are doing, that we will incarcerate you. We will prosecute you as a family. This doesn't speak very well of this administration, does it? The very administration that negotiated with the Taliban and returned their operatives for a soldier.